really nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation, and thanks to all of you for coming. It's good to see so many old friends. I was told I had 20 minutes, and I don't think I've ever done anything in 20 minutes. Whether I can do it or not, but we will. There will be on the website two papers. I did a talk for Collegium and two summers ago that I think pulled some pieces together, and then I did a piece for the Lilly Fellows annual conference at Xavier last fall on exactly the subject, the kind of Catholic contribution to American society. So those two pieces will be on the website, and we'll say a little more coherently probably than what I'll say today, and just offer a few thoughts about the history, and then I want to say some things about contemporary American Catholic higher education. We do have a rich, first of all, a set of frame, and the frame is to think about these schools as having three intersecting lines of responsibility. Academic, they're colleges and universities, first of all. Our president, Father Brooks, used to say it's a college and not a church. And then to me later on, he would say it's a college and not a staging ground for political actions. So they do have it, but they also have civic responsibilities and public responsibilities. They're not only are they chartered by the people of the several states, but as you know, they receive a lot of public money. And unlike Catholic elementary and secondary education, they're kind of intertwined by finances with the entire network of American higher education in ways that are more comparable perhaps to Catholic charities than they are to Catholic elementary and secondary education. So there's very distinct civic and political responsibilities. And then thirdly, they profess to be Catholic and therefore have, in some way, have some responsibilities within the faith community, the Catholic Church. So it's balancing those three lines of accountability that I'll kind of come back to in a little while. Phil Gleason has given us a wonderful history of Catholic higher education down to the Second Vatican Council after a lifetime of really rich essays on the subject. He brought them together in a wonderful book called Contending with Modernity that carries the story down to Vatican II, and that brings together all these very interesting, diverse stories of men's and women's colleges and universities across the landscape, which were, up until World War II, very much embedded in the immigrant Catholic subculture. They certainly thought of themselves as colleges, and they wanted to participate with other colleges in the higher education enterprise. They joined accrediting associations from the very beginning, and they were publicly responsible. But Phil would say they were very much defined by their Catholic identity. That's thus a contending with modernity. In the postmodernist church, these schools saw their distinctiveness and their difference, Phil says, by their difference from modern culture and modern society. I always thought that was something of a pose or a posture more than a stance, actually, because of course, the schools adapted quite readily to American practices of race and class. And in 1941, after Pearl Harbor, the bishops wrote to the to President Roosevelt that they not only would support the war effort, but, quote, we place at your disposal our institutions and their consecrated personnel, which is a pretty strong kind of way of accommodating yourself to the government. And, of course, the schools shouldn't filled up with GIs and people in training. And then after the war, with the help of the GI Bill, the schools really took off, and a lot of them really grew like Topsy and diversified the programs that they offered and entered upon a period of great growth and prosperity when those three pieces really did seem to fit together. You could be kind of faithfully Catholic and had a sense that we were building a strong academic enterprises and were enthusiastically patriotic. I went to Notre Dame in 1956 to 60. When I graduated in 1960, John Kennedy was running for president. Our commencement address was given by President Eisenhower. My diploma was handed to me by the baccalaureate celebrant, Cardinal Montini of Milan, when he became Pope Paul VI. My mother blew that picture up very large. Our loudest cheers that day were for Tom Dooley, the idealistic medical missionary from Indochina, who was a few months away from his death from cancer. So God, country, and Notre Dame. And I said that the Catholic contribution to American society was very clear that day. It was us. We were it, kind of. So it kind of did all hang together. Alice Gallen has taken Phil's history and brought it down to the post-Vatican II period and has told us the story of what happened after 1960 and after the opening of the Second Vatican Council and all the changes of the 60s. And how, really, in that background, that growth after World War II, a lot of strains had developed, particularly strains between an emerging group of very strong presidents and the religious orders that sponsored many of the schools. So in 1967, the leaders of Catholic higher education met at Land O'Lakes Wisconsin and issued the kind of manifesto that these colleges and universities wish to be authentic colleges and universities, and in order to do so, they must enjoy institutional autonomy and academic freedom. And that was not just words, because within 5 years, most of these schools handed over the schools to independent boards of trustees. That handing over, if you will, of responsibility, property charter to these independent boards with a majority of lay members in both men's and women's colleges was a remarkable, remarkable event, I think. And communities in these schools should be regularly reminded of that remarkable act of trust that these religious orders placed in the people who supported those schools. So that happened. The academic freedom part, the schools had already really affirmed the 1940 AAUP statement on academic freedom. There were some fights in theology and philosophy, and highly publicized fights in the 60s. But in general, the schools certainly made their own that value of academic freedom. What they didn't quite understand was that the professionalization of the faculty would also bring with it not just concerns about academic freedom, but academic self-governance. And it's a lot more painful story, I think, in the next 20 years of adjusting to the faculty's claim to have predominant say over the hiring and tenuring and promotion of faculty and over curriculum and academic matters. That took a little while to modernize kind of internal governance. The other thing at Land O'Lakes was the promise that was made that while enjoying institutional autonomy and academic freedom, going through that route of independence, that the schools would remain Catholic. Catholicism would be perceptibly present and effectively operative on the campuses. And the strategies for that involved the institutional commitment that they all made in the founding documents, the continuing presence of the religious orders. Nobody anticipated that the numbers of those religious orders and their resources would decline, change as rapidly as they did, the presence of the religious order, the presence of strong pastoral ministry, and probably most important, the bringing of theology out of the seminary and into the university campus. And the theology was clearly seen to be the academic carrier of Catholic mission and identity as these schools went through this professionalization and modernization. And Catholicism finally would be ensured by continuing dialogue with the bishops. And for 20, 25 years, the presidents and bishops enjoyed a very collaborative and cooperative relationship that assisted the schools very much, as the Vatican never saw this move towards separate incorporation as a good thing and regularly raised questions about Catholic mission and identity. But for most of the period, dialogue and trust between the strong presidents and some remarkable bishops who understood and appreciated Catholic higher education, Bishop James Malone of Youngstown, Ohio, Archbishop Borders of Baltimore, Cardinal Bernardine, Cincinnati and Chicago. Now, in recent years, I think we've had another change, and it's come really accompanying the ex corde ecclesiae debate, but it's not just Vatican intervention raising questions about the autonomy and independence of these schools, but changes in the self-understanding of American Catholics, including the population who constitute the schools. And really, Phil Gleason and I have had a running argument for 25 and 30 years about this. There's a generation, as a generation of those strong presidents passed, there's been a conservative resurgence in the church, and very important Catholic intellectuals, Peter Steinfeld, James Burchill, Michael Buckley, raised questions about whether in this process of maturation and Americanization and growth and development, something important had been sacrificed, kind of the Catholic identity and mission of the school. Phil has been the strongest voice for that. And in a recent talk about a year ago, Phil said, quote, ecclesiastical authority, he underlined those words, has helped stem what might have been an unintended slide in the kind of secularization experienced by Protestants a century earlier. Well, you've heard that argument before. It's all over. And it's not just heard from conservatives, or it's heard from mainstream members of the community sometimes. So taking our three lines of responsibility, the argument is that we have accommodated to American academic values and structures, hire anyone, compete with them, ape the research universities, and in so doing we have mirrored, and this is what I want to emphasize, the larger accommodation of the Catholic community as a whole to American society and culture, and in the process have placed our identity and perhaps even our integrity at risk. What we have to do now is to reestablish our distance and difference from others in order to recover a distinctive sense of our identity and mission. That kind of argument, I think, is the dominant argument. In the paper I did, Phil's won the argument for the moment, that the voices of influence and power in the Catholic community are very much in support of Phil's worries about the schools. I have worried about Catholic identity on campus as well, and I think I've made three constructive contributions in that regard, but I've argued with Phil and others for many years. I would tell a different story, not a story of the Catholic community as a whole, not a story told in the passive voice of accommodation and cultural surrender, but a story told in the active voice of liberation, solidarity, and shared responsibility. The movement of American Catholics from margin to mainstream was and is good news. The decision made by religious orders of men and women to accompany them on that journey was appropriate. The world we have created for ourselves does blur boundaries, but it enlarges imaginations and keeps hope alive. The Kingdom of God is not a great big Catholic church after all. The now dominant story about integrity usually, but not always, uses countercultural language for subcultural purposes. It is often, once again, a posture. Denounce the culture, but don't miss lunch. That's kind of a cynical. I was going to put it in an academic setting. Be sure to attend the mission and identity meeting, where we'll talk about the failures of modern culture, but don't forget to get your grant proposal into the Defense Department. I guess that's it is often, so once again, a posture. I would like a story that would be different, that would use Americanist language, these are, after all, my people, to ground historical and political responsibility. So let's return then to our three lines of responsibility, academic, ecclesial, and civic, noticing how closely they correspond to our own daily experience of balancing the demands of professional, civic, and moral responsibility. Our institutions acknowledge these three areas of commitment and responsibility because they correspond to the legitimate demands of modern life. And to take advice from David Hollenbeck, we should approach each with a spirit of genuine solidarity. So I'll take the three, and I'm trying to put this in a kind of provocative way. I'm not sure I can back it all up. First, the academic. We all acknowledge that good academic work, research, and teaching is a public good. What do we contribute to America's side? We do a public good simply by good academic work, though we rarely ask what that claim requires of us. Good academic work, like any good work, is also a religious good. In our case, an altogether Catholic good. In the spirit of solidarity, there is no us and them in the intellectual life, but acknowledgement of shared responsibility to confront basic human questions of meaning and mutual obligation. Approach those questions in the context, as Hollenbeck reminds us, of a violent contemporary history. The problems of modernity and postmodernity are our problems. Intellectual work is, or at least should be, carried out on behalf of the entire human family. Theology and religious studies offer important resources, and I don't underestimate the conflict and differences between those two. Both offer important resources for the communities of knowledge that constitute modern intellectual and academic life. Many scholars and teachers at Boston College, including people in this room, exemplify that solidarity, as does the Jesuit Institute, the Lonergan Institute, and many other BC initiatives with which I'm less familiar. Catholic colleges and universities, with the help of Lilly and Pew, have helped reintroduce religion into undergraduate education to the public benefit. But we all know that we have much to do to bring religious and moral seriousness into curriculum and campus culture, into departments and disciplines, research and graduate education. Contrary to popular belief, those Jesuit mission and identity officers are actually very important, not just to ensure that we fulfill specifically Catholic responsibilities, but that we attend to our basic academic mission and make the contributions to that mission that our heritage and our Catholic connections assist us to make. Contributions to American intellectual and cultural life. We need to encourage our sometimes nervous Jesuit colleagues, as they once again gather to reflect on the society's future, to continue their commitment to justice and the poor, precisely within and not apart from their continuing commitment to serious intellectual and academic work. We have been blessed as academic institutions by Jesuit sponsorship and by Jesuit colleagues, and they need to be told that. Academic. Second, our ecclesial commitment. We have some responsibility for Catholic intelligence. And because an intelligent Catholic community is a public good, I would argue it is, that just by doing our Catholic work well, we contribute public benefit. Our Catholic work is an altogether American responsibility. I am tempted to tell stories of my Notre Dame class of 1960 to illustrate the importance of Catholic higher education to American civic life in the last generation. You thought I was kidding when I said that the contribution to American society was us. But I could tell some stories, really some quite remarkable people in that class. The education of aspiring Catholics, us, was a public good, as was the development of Catholic parishes and Catholic social services. Historically and today, a vital and intelligent Catholic community is a worthwhile public objective. Unfortunately, on this score, our record is less impressive than it should be. Our colleges and universities should be in creative partnership with other Catholic ministries. We should be alert to our unique opportunities to promote international solidarity, and we should be exploring Catholic studies strategies to supplement our commitment to theology in the last generation. Furthermore, we should accept a greater share of responsibility for our church instead of having nervous breakdowns over the vagina monologues. That's a reference to the awful, awful fight at Notre Dame. I just was so distressed by the fight over vagina monologues and then the controversy that took place within the Holy Cross Fathers and attacks, and then John Cavadini, who's a very admirable person, again, being so critical of Father Jenkins. I just thought it was really distressing. Let me be as strong as possible here. While I defer to no one in my admiration for BC's response to the multiple crises in the American church, the acclaim your university has received, even amazingly acclaim for courage, is a measure of our overall failure in American Catholic higher education to take responsibility for the moral integrity, pastoral competence, and intellectual vitality of our American church. In this forum, I would insist that this has been a civic as well as an ecclesial disappointment. Because in fact, an intelligent and vital Catholic community, as I say, is a public good. And the disintegration of the church and its ministries would be a public disaster. More directly to the argument I have outlined, we Catholics on campus must resist countercultural language and subcultural strategies. And in a spirit of solidarity, we cover our historic American commitments and consequent responsibilities. Parentheses. If you like, I'll send you a paper I've written on the renewal of Catholic Americanism. That's another. Bill Shea was supposed to be here. He calls me the last Americanist. Finally, what of civic responsibility and solidarity? A few years ago, hundreds of college and university presidents, including our own, Holy Cross and Boston College, signed wingspread declarations on civic responsibility in which they pledged to reinvigorate their civic and social commitments. They even said they would undertake civic audits to determine how every area of institutional life was fulfilling their university's civic obligations. A number of universities around the country actually did that. Minnesota, Penn, I think. I know how hard BC has worked to build relationships with the neighboring community and to engage important issues of human rights and social justice. Much has been done to familiarize faculty and students with Catholic social teaching, to connect burgeoning programs of community and public service with Catholic and Jesuit social ministries, and to make Catholic and Jesuit international connections resources for research and teaching. Those of us who are not Jesuits need to encourage our Jesuit colleagues to continue, underline, stress their 1974 commitment to the service of faith and promotion of justice as academic and public goods. I keep saying these things, of course, because the Jesuits have entered into a process of community reflection culminate in a general congregation and the selection of a new general. I actually wrote a memo to the Holy Cross delegates to the regional and provincial. Long, whiny memos. Student community service, community-based learning, and community partnerships are excellent expressions of solidarity, but Catholic and Jesuit challenges to historic responsibilities for peace and justice cuts much deeper than that. It should cut, it does cut, the questions of power and privilege, the politics of knowledge, and the politics of higher education. College and universities, professors and staffs with the courage to face those questions would make a huge contribution to American civic life. Tell your Jesuit friends that as they consider their future and select their new leadership. So to end, your question then is of the contribution of Catholic higher education to American life is also a question about the Americanness of Catholics and their church. The question risks our usual segmentation as if my three areas of responsibility, academic, ecclesial, and civic, are a checklist. Academic vice president for Jesuit and Catholic mission, vice president for public and community relations. But that separation itself should be approached with caution. To be a Catholic is to suppose that when I am a good Catholic, I am by that very goodness a better American. And that when I am a good citizen, I am by that very goodness a better Catholic. And when I practice my vocation as an American historian, I carry out my Catholic responsibilities quite as much as I do when I gather with my Catholic brothers and sisters for worship and prayer. And when I so gather, I enrich my vocation as a professional with meaning in ways that I believe also enriches the communities in which I do my work. The challenge to all of us, I guess, is to reject countercultural claims and impulses tied to subcultural strategies and invite one another to consider the possibility that engagement with Catholic and Jesuit mission identity here at BC and at Holy Cross is at the very heart of our shared commitment to scholarship, teaching, and the intellectual life. As for the Catholics among us, our American Catholic journey has carried us and our colleges and universities into the centers of American life. There we find ourselves entwined with others in networks that constitute various forms of common life and shared responsibility, whether we like it or not. That liberating journey across subcultural boundaries was a very good thing for us and for the communities whose life we share. Or at least it can turn out to be a good thing, provided we make good decisions about what to do next. That is a personal question for each of us and a political question for all of us. Thanks for allowing me to help ask that question. So that's...